Part 52. The meeting in Derby on Friday morning was useful to bring me, and Supermarine, up to date on the progress being made with the Neen engine, which was going to power the attacker. I was also invited to a meeting in the afternoon that was mainly to let different people involved in the management of parts inventories for different Rolls-Royce aero engines get to know each other. Rolls knew that to have quick access to parts, different users would keep modest stocks on hand. However, sometimes it was really helpful to be able to borrow a part from another user, since getting items from Derby might take longer than desired, especially if they still had to be made. This meeting turned out to have a pivotal role in my life, though at the time I regarded it more as a social event. Basically a bunch of men. In that era it was always men, though because women are used to running a household they are often better at inventories and supply matters than men. And we sat around a big table in a cloud of smoke. I was almost the only non-smoker. We each introduced ourselves and gave a capsule summary of our company and our role in it. There was also a man from Rolls who would be keeping a directory of contact information and would maintain an approximate list of what we had on hand from deliveries and orders placed. It was a useful idea, though given Supermarine was building new types, there would be fewer places we might find parts than for some others. The meeting had a desultory and indecisive discussion of whether there would be any compensation for helping out, but the consensus seemed to be that until we learned how much the process would be used, we would be better to leave things to be worked out as and when there was actual sharing. Still, it was clear that some contacts were made and names and faces were being put together. It would likely not directly help Rolls, but it was fairly certain it wouldn't hurt either. Part 53. During the midday dinner break, I found a payphone and called Nigel and left a message that we'd arrive at around 11:30. Might as well get an easy morning. The journey by train was only half an hour. I got back to the hotel at 5 and found Maud taking a rest on the bed. She'd been window shopping. There were now more things available, but anything interesting required points. We decided to eat in the hotel restaurant and went down around 6. As we were waiting for the head waiter to come to seat us, two of the men from the afternoon meeting came up behind us. "It's Ted Newman of Supermarine, isn't it?" said the man I recalled was with TCA. "Trans-Canada Airlines." "Yes. If I recall, you are Gerald Lapointe of TCA, and you are Michael McPhee of Canadair. Let me introduce my wife, Maud." "Actually it's Gerard, but with the noise in the room, I'm surprised you got our names at all. If you hadn't been sitting one over from me, I'd not have got your name." The head waiter was hovering. We decided to eat together. "Not many wives get to come along to these events," Gerard said. "We only got married last Saturday," Maud answered. "Ted's boss said I could come and be included in the expenses here. We took a few days in London." "Wow," Michael said. "A working honeymoon." "We might not have had that. I only got demobbed in February." "If we weren't in transport and aircraft manufacture, both of us might just be getting out now ourselves," Gerard said. "I gather the war postponed your marriage," Michael said. Maud explained how we'd come to meet. She didn't add how our decision was based on situations that were in many respects unromantic. "Strange, I now knew that I would. Did. Love her. We'd do all right together." Michael and Gerard were explaining their names. "Given my name, you'd think of me as the French-Canadian," Gerard said. "My grandfather was a true Quebecer, pure Lane, but he fell in love with a Scots lass whose husband died of some disease or other on the boat over. And now my generation mostly is Anglo, though I manage some of the dual or local dialect. Now Michael here is the true French-Canadian." "Yes. My great-grandfather was orphaned in the cholera epidemic when the Irish were escaping the potato famine. He was adopted by a French-Canadian family near Trois-Rivières. The Archbishop of Quebec asked families to do this, but the adoptions weren't formal, so they kept their names. There's folklore that the orphans asked the bishop if they could keep their names. I don't know if that's true. And from what I've heard in my family, the families wanted the Irish kids as servants or cheap labor, though apparently my great-grandfather said he was well-treated compared to Ireland. But then he married a local Quebec girl and I grew up with French first, and learnt English on the street in Montreal from Jewish kids.
There's a Jewish community there?
Maud asked.
Yes, several streets.
Quite busy.
We are looking after a French girl who is an orphan because the Nazis killed her parents in the camps. The father was of Jewish origin. We plan to adopt her.
Will it be easier to adopt her now you are married?
Gerard asked.
Probably, Maud said.
I think it advanced our decision to get married, but I can tell you that I've not been happier for a long time.
Me too, I said.
To change the subject, I asked, was your visit here useful, directing the question to both. Michael said Canadair is building a variant of the DC-4, but rather than use the Pratt & Whitney radials that Douglas puts in, we're going to use Merlins. Hence the interest in part. Gerard added, and TCA is already flying Lancastrians, so already have a need for a reliable parts supply. But both of us were also here to learn about what might be coming down the pipe.
Yes, I was here to get up to date on the Neen.
I'd guess you'd be looking into the Dart turboprop?
I answered.
We're taking notes on the whole range, but met with the Dart people this morning, so missed the Neen presentation, Gerard said.
When do you head back to Canada?
I asked.
Monday. Long, noisy flight on a Lancastrian from Prestwick.
You folks?
We're going to Leicester tomorrow to see an old RAF pal before we go home on Sunday. He runs a salvage operation.
Actually, might be of interest to you.
He's got about a dozen Merlins and some parts that he's getting off some of the wartime airfields in East Anglia.
So they're used ones, and also the parts?
Yes.
But Nigel was with me in France and Belgium and Holland. He knows about keeping records on parts and hours of service, etc. No doubt someone will get some decent engines and parts from him at a good price, and he'll do well at the same time.
Be good to have his name and address for you, Gerard, Michael said.
Or you could come with us tomorrow morning and meet him. The train journey is only about half an hour from here, so you could make it there and back easily, though I don't know when you were planning to go up to Scotland.
We'll go up to Glasgow Sunday via Edinburgh, then get a car to Prestwick with the TCA crew.
We don't carry lots of passengers on the Lancastrian.
Plenty of mail, of course.
Will you be able to use the new Heathrow Airport soon?
I asked.
Gerard said, supposed to be under wraps, but I think come September you'll see something in the news.
Michael said maybe we should go with Ted and Maud tomorrow.
We'd have to entertain ourselves here anyway, and if Ted's friend has anything useful, it would be a feather in your cap, Gerard.
Part 54.
Nigel was on the platform. Our group turned out to be a bit of a nuisance blocking foot traffic, so we had to move to the side of the platform and let the rush move past us. After introductions, Nigel said, when I mentioned the stuff I'd found to Ted, I never thought he'd spread the word so fast, but I couldn't be happier. I just hope we won't bore Maud too much if I take you round the yard to show you the operation, then we'll find something to eat.
That would be very good, Gerard said.
Actually, if we just have a quick look at what you have and exchange addresses, then you can let us off somewhere interesting in the town and we can play tourist before going back to Derby, and you can catch up with Ted and Maud.
That works for me, Nigel said.
Nigel had a 10-year-old Rover saloon. Well, all motor cars now were old, since no new ones had been marketed since 1939. It was, for England, a fairly big car, but five of us made for a squeeze in the back seat. Fortunately, the Hughes salvage yard wasn't far from the station. Much of the yard was a typical scrap yard, and there were a few men working moving some cut-up metal into heaps with a crane that had a magnet. However, Nigel led us to an area with a pair of large Nissan huts, each about 100 feet long. Each had a large garage-style door, but we went in through a standard personnel entrance. Inside it was spotless, with tables having different parts laid out beside measurement jigs. There were several Merlins on engine stands. "Nice operation," Michael said. "Yes. Not what I expected," Gerard added. "Wish we'd had such tidy conditions at Thornycroft's," Maud added. I'd forgotten that she'd been working there. Stupid of me, and showed typical male prejudice. There really wasn't much to talk about now, since show trumped tell by a good margin. After a walk about both sheds, Nigel and the two Canadians exchanged information and we drove back towards the center of town. We let Michael and Gerard off near the cathedral that they wanted to look at and Nigel drove us out to the Swan Inn, which was about 8 miles north. We registered and put our luggage away while Nigel waited for us in the bar, where we joined him for something to eat. There were some Cornish pasties and a good soup on offer, which hit the spot. "So tell me more about the two of you," Nigel said. Maud related the story, then asked, "What about you, Nigel? You've not mentioned any wife or family. I hope you haven't had the sorrows that Ted and I have." "No. Not very interesting. Had a girlfriend that I'd been going out with since 1938. We were starting to talk of a wedding when the war started. And we kept talking right into the end of 1942 when I was told I was going to join the RAF. Sort of like Ted, since the salvage yard was considered essential industry and I was in a reserved occupation. At least until they needed my special skills. For some reason I got a higher rank as flight lieutenant," I said. "Probably because I gave some toffer-nosed twit in the administration a bit of sharp tongue," Nigel confessed. "Anyway, Josephine decided that she didn't like writing letters when she could be dancing with some yank from the US Army Air Force. Except his plane was blown out of the sky by one of those Messerschmitt comets after he'd put a bun in her oven. She and the kid moved away sometime soon after VE Day." "I'm sorry to hear that, Nigel," Maud said. "We spent the rest of the day in some pleasant villages. I suppose we could have done the tourist things in Leicester, but it was good to see some countryside that didn't have bomb craters. Also to walk a bit along some country footpaths. Nigel took us to the Three Crows in Barrow-upon-Soar for dinner. He did let us pay for drinks before dinner at least. The food was, given the strictures of rationing, very good. Fortunately, he recognized that we were tired from a busy day, and we were back at the Swan by 8:30. After a small argument, and the assurances that a local driver would serve as taxi to Loughborough, which was nearer than Leicester for the train, Nigel paid for our accommodation and we said our farewells. Part 55. We didn't have a bath in our room in the Swan. Too ancient. But they had put in a basin with hot and cold running water. We each took a good wash with warm water. A bit of a luxury. I shaved to save having to in the morning. We fell into each other on the bed and, in a manner that was a bit different from other times, simply enjoyed ourselves in a quick and rather unfussy coupling. Lying in my arms afterwards, Maud said it was a nice day. "I'm glad you brought Gerard and Michael with us. Perhaps it will help Nigel's business." "I hope so. And I hope he finds a nice girl. Well, woman. He's got to be nearly 30, if not a bit more." "Yes. and a pity for the woman and her child.
What did you make of what Gerard said about TCA looking for someone like you to run their parts operation? When you said your brother was in Calgary, he more or less implied you should be jumping to get to Canada. That Joseph should have told you of the opportunities in Canada.
I'm not sure. Until Gerard mentioned the possibility, I'd not given any thought to leaving England.
Perhaps you should at least write up your qualifications. It's likely a good idea even if you don't send them. But somehow I think you should send them along with a whole lot of questions. And I should find out what I can about life in Canada.
It's a big place. I think Montreal is not much more than halfway to Calgary from here. I'm exaggerating a bit, but the scale is about right.
Hard to imagine. From what they said, there's a lot of French spoken. And a Jewish community. I wonder what the education is like. It could be good for Paula as a place to finish growing up.
Maud, the more I get to know you, the more I like you.
Why don't we talk to Paula and also all three of us start to learn more about Canada and about Montreal as well as how we might get there? And I'll get my history written down so we can send it to Gerard.
Maud said, and Mr. Rushworth can now have a copy of our marriage license to start adoption proceedings.
Part 56. We were home before 6 o'clock on the Sunday. The journey was straightforward, though we did need a taxi across London between the stations. That was something that should be fixed. The railways could at least negotiate with London Transport and work out single tickets that allowed passengers to transfer more easily. When we got in, we found Paula in the kitchen making us our supper. She was doing soup. As she put it, I didn't want to make something that would spoil if you were late. Before we'd left, I'd packed up my things and put them in the front bedroom. Paula and Enid had set up my old room for Paula. It looked different. Feminine. It was strange being in the front bedroom. I'd hardly been in here at all. I carried up our suitcases, and after she visited the WC, Maud came in.
"Hope I don't make you feel pushed out of your own room," I said.
"It was good to have a few days to get used to each other. It'll be all right. We talk to each other. There's bound to be some friction on some things."
"The smaller the issue, the larger the fight," I suggested.
"Probably true, but let's hope nothing too annoying."
"Shall we eat outside? It's rather nice out."
Part 57. "Did you get the postcard of Tower Bridge?" I asked Paula.
"Oh. Yes. I meant to say thank you. It was nice to get that."
"Did you have a nice honeymoon?"
"We did, Paula. Very nice," Maud said. "Ted and I haven't known each other very long. During this last week, we found we rather like being together, at least I like being with him."
"Yes, I think we got along much better than I would ever have imagined. And we talked and learnt more about each other," I added.
"Did everything go all right here?" Maud queried.
"Oh yes. Mrs. Brownlow seemed to like having me there to help with Jack at bedtime. He's a bit of a terror about wanting to stay up. I read him a story each night."
"Do we owe Enid any money for food?" Maud asked.
"I had some money. I took 7 and 6 from the post office account and I used it to buy some of the groceries for here, but I split some of the items and gave her some. She said she didn't want to take anything, but I could tell it was helpful. So we had a sort of mock argument, and then she took the things.
I said, thank you, Paula. We've also got a little present of a bottle of sherry for her. Actually got it before we got married.
And one for George too. We'll take them round later in the week. Also, we met some people who gave us some ideas about the future. Well, a possible future for us.
Oh. Do tell. I'm all ears.
Well, first, are you still all right with us adopting you?
Of course.
Where would I go? Paula looked a little worried. It's what Maud and I want, but it would be bad if you were just being polite.
No, no.
I've not felt I belonged for a long time. Aunt Matilda really was not doing very well. She wasn't always making sense. I had great fear she was going funny. Like old people sometimes do. This was news, but it made no difference now.
Well, we've got the marriage certificate copies. Did you take one round to Mr. Rushworth?
Yes, on Monday on the way to school. I put it through his letterbox. I'll phone tomorrow and ask if everything was in order, though I know it was.
Maud said in Derby, we met two Canadians from Montreal. One of them works for Trans-Canada Airlines and the other for Canadair. They were looking into engines and engine parts. Mr. Lapointe, the TCA man, said there could be an opportunity for Ted with them. We're going to at least investigate, but the decision has to be from all of us, because it's a big step.
Paula said we had Canada in geography last year. It's so big. I think Ted said his brother Joseph is in Calgary, but isn't Montreal at the other end?
Not quite, but you are more or less right. Perhaps we should get a small atlas.
I've got my school one, Maud said. I always like looking at the maps. I'll go and get it.
We were quiet, watching the early evening sun of summertime drift to the west. When Maud came back with the atlas and a ruler, we moved our chairs close, Paula on one side and me on the other of Maud.
Maud said, there we are. If I take the ruler, I get about 4 inches between Montreal and St. John's.
And where is the scale?
Oh. There it is, 250 miles to the inch.
So 1,000 miles.
But St. John's is in Newfoundland.
That's not part of Canada, is it?
Paula said.
No.
You're right, but it gives us an idea of the size of the land. And Montreal to Calgary is 8 inches or 2,000 miles as the crow flies.
Ted, how far is Montreal from here?
I think 3,000 miles give or take a few.
Wow!
Paula said.
Anyway, Paula, did you learn that a lot of people in Montreal speak French?
Maud asked.
Gerard said there's a lot of English too.
I think I do remember something about that, since they were a French colony until 1700 and something, when a man named Wolfe captured the city of Quebec. I remember because the teacher left off the accent egg on the E.
It looks like well over 100 miles between Quebec and Montreal, I said.
If we go there, we'll have to get used to thinking of these distances, Maud said.
I added, Gerard mentioned there was also a quite active Jewish community in Montreal.
I don't know if that is of any interest to you, Paula, but it could be a start to learn more about your family.
Perhaps. But I'm not sure whether I want to know.
Part 58. Bureaucracies usually grind slowly. However, in the case of our application to adopt Paula, there was, it seemed, an almost indecent haste to get her file off the books of the welfare agency. By August 1st, Paula was officially our daughter. We celebrated by taking a trip into the New Forest on a Saturday by bus and having a picnic. The New Forest ponies watched us carefully from the other side of a dry stone wall, which fortunately kept them from our sandwiches.
especially now bread was rationed. We were also back to the old national loaf. Nutritious, but not very appetizing. Paula and Maud spent some time in the library to learn a bit more about Canada and about Montreal. They wrote to Canada House. We'd seen it in London. And asked for brochures about emigration to Canada. Within 10 days, a packet came which listed the technical requirements but also described some aspects of Canada and Canadian life. Just as we got the adoption confirmed, we decided to start to get passports or related travel documents. Whether or not we emigrated, it seemed a good idea to get our documents in good order. For Maud and I, the passport seemed relatively easy. It appeared Paula could go on either my or Maud's passport, though I feared her background might cause some concerns. I wrote to Gerard Lapointe within a week after the end of our honeymoon. I had written up my background and work history, and Maud took it to a typist who prepared it in 3 copies, so I'd have one for myself and another to send somewhere else if need be. I sent it off with a letter saying I'd be interested in learning what opportunities TCA might have for me. Part 59. On August 23rd, I got a letter from Gerard on TCA letterhead. It was an offer of a job running the TCA parts supply and inventory. Maud said it says a salary of $6,000 per year.
How much is that?
About £1,500, I said. £1,500. Maud exclaimed. Isn't that about 1.5 times what you earn now? Yes. And my salary here is considered quite good.
Does that mean we're going? Paula asked.
I think so, I said, but we need to think of what we'll need to do. Maud said they say we'll be given a place on one of the Lancastrian flights and an allowance to ship 500 weight of boxes by sea. So it is a good offer. Our main concern is going to be having some money when we get there, since there are exchange controls. I think we'd better check those in the next day or so. I wonder where Maud learnt about exchange controls. She must have been reading something in the newspapers. But she was right. It turned out that in March the amount a person could take out for travel was reduced from £100 to £75, and from £50 to £40 for those under 16. So £190 for all of us. It likely would not go far in Canada. In the evening of the 24th, Saturday night, the 3 of us decided after supper that we'd accept the offer. It would, of course, be conditional on getting immigration papers. The letter of offer said we could use it to get our immigration papers via Canada House. We would need medical examinations. The letter asked us to reply to Gerard Lapointe of our acceptance and direct any questions to him. We wrote the letter of acceptance that night. I mentioned that I would follow up with some questions once we had contacted the Canadian immigration people. Part 60. I decided to be open with Supermarine about the offer. I'd been with them a long time, and they'd treated me well. I telephoned Miss Shoreham in the morning and told her what was going on and that I'd like to tell Mr. Gooch myself. I figured Miss Shoreham would know very quickly anyway, and her reaction was, "Is it a good offer?" she asked. "They're offering $6,000 a year and relocation to Montreal." "You really can't ignore that," was the reaction of a very practical woman. Gooch also took the news with equanimity. I mentioned that there were still a number of procedures to satisfy, so that it was not a fait accompli, and I would still be around for a while. Also, I told him of my conversations with James Hall, and that I thought there would be no serious issues of continuity. "It's been a turbulent couple of years for you, Ted. I hope it will go well for you. And for you and Supermarine, Mr. Gooch." Part 61. The next day in the canteen I spotted Desmond Snow, who ran the accounting section.
Desmond, may I sit with you and get your ideas on something?
Sure,
Ted.
Not usual that you fellows in supply and inventory need too much help.
It's a bit of a personal matter, actually.
I've been offered a rather decent salary by Trans-Canada Airlines in Montreal.
Yes.
They can outpay us by a long mile.
Let me guess.
You're wondering how you managed to move as much of your money as possible.
Has someone else asked you before?
Actually wondered about it myself, mainly for my son. I'm too old to be emigrating, but I think it might be right for him.
Do you have any advice?
Well, the controls won't let you convert much or take it out in currency. There's apparently a premium market where you sell your pounds at a discount, but I'm not clear on whether that is properly set up yet.
There's the under-the-counter ways.
Some people smuggle notes out, or sovereigns if they have any. The fur and diamond trade are rife with fiddles to export stuff paid for in pounds and sold in dollars. Also some artworks and things like that. Trade like that's legal if the value declared is fair, but full of bureaucracy and spivs. Fair is a slippery word.
What about something paid for here and sold there that is fair value?
I asked. That's likely legal. Especially if you are resident there when you receive the dollars. UK law should not apply to a resident of Canada. The problem is finding something you can buy here and ship over. All the ration coupons make that awkward, but perhaps not impossible.
Part 62. Can I have a quick word?
I said after dinner, poking my head round the door of James Hall's office.
Yes. Come in.
I'm working on setting up some tracking mechanisms for the NEEM using your notes from the Derby meeting. But I'm not in the middle of anything critical.
It's a consequence of that meeting I wanted to talk to you about.
Oh. I hope there's no disaster brewing. Like the Vulture engine. The Vulture was an attempt by Rolls-Royce to put two Peregrine V12 engines together as an X24 engine. For banks of six cylinders in an X arrangement of 42 liters displacement. It tended to shake itself to pieces. The slightly different H-block of the Napier Sabre had similar complaints, though it did get into production, particularly for the Hawker Typhoon. But to return to James Hall, I said no. I hope it's nothing like a disaster. The thing is, I met a man from Trans-Canada Airlines there, and they've offered me a rather good salary to work with them in Montreal. Assuming all the formalities work out. And there are an awful lot of them. My current job will be open again, and I'll be recommending you take over.
Thank you, Mr. Newman. You've honored your promise.
Well, it looks like you will, assuming things all go through satisfactorily.
Yes.
Fingers crossed. Anyway, I wanted to let you know so we can make sure things here don't see any bumps in the road. In particular, I suggest we write to all the people who were at the meeting and introduce you. For now, we needn't mention I may be leaving, just stress the importance of maintaining contacts. And I'll ask you to be a bit aggressive in taking notes and asking questions for the same general purpose.
That makes sense.
And won't hurt even if things should fall through, but for both of us, I really hope they don't.
Part 63.
I had to take a day off in the second week of September, and Paula missed one of the first days of the new school year. If we stayed in England, it would be her final year. So we could go to Canada House. Fortunately, we had an appointment, as there were lots of people queuing to learn how to emigrate to Canada. Since I had an offer of employment, we were moved right to the front. We each had a medical examination, and all of these were satisfactory. We wondered if Paula's origins in France would cause trouble, but though all the documents we had for her were examined, and some notes were made, nothing was said. The very busy state of the offices seemed to work in our favor. About 3:30, we were given a stamped and initial document to present to immigration officials on landing in Canada, wished good luck, and rather unceremoniously pointed to the exit. There was a Lion's Corner house opposite Canada House, and we went in and had Welsh rabbit, iced buns, and tea. Except Paula had coffee. I wanted to remember a bit of when father and mother were still alive in France. Here in England, I almost never smell coffee. Then she looked a little stricken. Oh. I hope that didn't mean I'm not grateful to you both and... I said, Paula, in our family. And we are a family. We are never going to be afraid to talk about the other families we belong to. If we try to do that, it will only be difficult and, besides, we should remember all the people we loved. Part 64. 161, Radstock Road, Woolston, England, September 10, 1946. Gerard Lapointe, TCA, Dorval, Quebec, Canada. Dear Gerard, this is to let you know we now have passed our medicals and have our immigration permit, so now we will await confirmation that we fly to Montreal on October 28. Following your instructions, we are packing household items and will arrange for them to be shipped by sea to Montreal with TCA as our contact address. As you are aware, we are restricted to bringing only £190 sterling with us. Nigel Hughes has been in touch to confirm you have asked me to arrange payment for a Merlin engine priced at £450 FOB your Dorval address so you can evaluate one of his inventory. Since I will be repaid in Canada at the official exchange rate, it will allow us to bring our modest monies. We have been advised that this should not contravene British exchange controls. Given that a new Merlin was priced at £2,000, TCA should get a bargain, though I am sure you, ultimately including me, will be giving it a thorough evaluation. We look forward to our new start in Canada. Yours sincerely, Edward Newman and family. 161, Radstock Road, Woolston, England, September 10, 1946. Lawrence Lorimer, 80 Avenue 19E, Aptouane, Lachine, Quebec, Canada. Dear 50, since you left to go back to Canada last year, I've been meaning to get in touch, but have had a rather hectic time. Given it is less than 12 months since we said farewell, I've returned to Supermarine, got married, adopted a daughter, been offered a job at TCA, and will be coming to Montreal by air, leaving London October 28th. So maybe you'll forgive me not getting in touch beforehand. It was my new daughter, Paula, actually Pole, since she is originally French and her partly Jewish parents were murdered in the Nazi camps, who pointed out that Lac Hein is a Montreal suburb neighboring Dorval. I'm hoping that we can meet and catch up soon after our arrival. Moreover, we'll be very interested to learn of places where we can live, as I'll be surprised if accommodation is not in short supply, as it is here. Looking forward to reconnecting. Yours sincerely, Ted Newman, with Maud and Paula. Part 65. Maud said, "Why do you call him 50? His initials are LL, in Roman numerals 50-50, which got abbreviated. You men. Always giving each other nicknames." Part 66. September 21st. The equinox. We took a walk on Southampton Common. As we walked, we talked and imagined what we might find in Canada. It will be very cold in winter. We'll need good clothing and boots, Paula said. If we could find some Arctic clothing that didn't need points, we could use it instead of straw to pack the crockery, Maud mused.
That's a good idea, I said. What about the Friday market? Might they not have some stuff being disposed of by the military?
I've not been to the Friday market for at least a year, Maud said. Given Paula will be leaving the school soon, why don't you send a note saying you need her with you next Friday and go and see what you can find?
Yes, we can take a look.
Take plenty of coin and a few 10-bob notes, I suggested.
What about boots?
Paula said. Wellingtons are no use in the cold.
Any chance that they might have some at the market? I asked.
Perhaps we'll have to wait to get boots in Canada, Maud said.
But we'll look.
Though how will we buy things for you?
Coats can.
Perhaps should. Be loose-fitting. I'm not so much different in height from you, and you can take a tape measure and see how much my current coat is loose on you if you pull it out at the front. For boots, we can make some cardboard outlines of my feet. And again, we don't want boots too tight. I can wear double socks in the cold. We may be building castles in the air and they'll have no suitable items. On the other hand, if we can pick up some woolies, they'd be useful. I wonder if such items would be saleable in Canada.
No idea.
But good woolens could be sensible, as long as we pack them with mothballs, I said.
Mothballs.
Paula. Make sure we get some. Part 67. 80 Avenue 19E, Apt 1. Lac Hine, Quebec, Canada. October 1st, 1946. Dear Ted and family. Great to hear from you. I'm writing my phone number at the bottom. If my girlfriend answers, you may want Paula to talk, as Denise's English isn't so good. And her cousin Mart isn't much better with English, but she does have a house, and a daughter Lise, but her husband Henri was in the mess at the Walter and Causeway and didn't make it. She's had a couple of boarders, and they haven't been good experiences, so when I mentioned you had a family, she suggested that at least it would be worth a try if you are interested. Given the shortage of accommodation, I've taken a chance and given her a bit on account to cover October. You'd have two bedrooms and share the rest of the house, which is about 4 miles from the airport. There are buses, but you'll probably want to try to find a car or someone to pool with. I've got myself a small trucking business. Not much different from the RCAF except I get to take the risks and keep the profits. So you're in the loop, I called TCA and eventually talked with Gerard Lapointe. He was glad that I found you a place and that you can go there straight away. I'll meet the Lancastrian. Lapointe says to start work formally the following Monday, but to phone when you've got your head straight after the long flight. Should explain that I came home to find my wife shacked up with her former boss. We're getting a divorce. We'll fill you in when you're here. Your buddy. 50. Maud said 50 is really being helpful. I hope we can fit in all right with Mart and Lise. I speak a little French. School stuff plus what I picked up in Normandy. We'll learn. I wrote back to 50 immediately to let him know we'd take up the offer with Mart. We'd have to see how things worked out. Two women in one kitchen could be another war. Part 68. We'd already started to organize our belongings and had found some tea chests to pack. I knew where to get things weighed, and, being in Southampton, we should be able to find a ship going to Montreal. Weighing the chests was something that would still be awkward to arrange to check that we did not go over 500 weight. It occurred to me that the Canadians might mean the short measure of £100 rather than the Imperial 112. A big difference. When I talked to Maud about this, she suggested we should just assume Imperial and that if we were wrong it would likely be overlooked. Since July, Paula had been collecting straw and newspaper and other things to serve as packing materials. A necessity that neither Maud nor I had registered we would need, and which would be difficult to find in a hurry. Then, as mentioned, we thought of using clothing. Sometime in the middle of July, I'd managed to figure out that the light in the front room could be made to work. The room was now our headquarters for organizing our belongings. On one side of the room were the things that we were going to ship, though we had some pieces of cardboard with the names of things to be shipped, but that we still wanted to use. On the other side of the room, we put the things to sell, and indeed started to tell people about them. The newsagent charged threepence to put up small announcements on 3x5 cards. We used this to advertise some of the furniture and possessions to be sold. Maud was the only one of us to have any things really. We did have the furniture we were using, but decided to sacrifice some of it and use the tea chests instead of the table. We used our suitcases and other bags instead of chests of drawers. Gradually we got down to just a couple of kitchen chairs, and then I managed to make some bomb-damaged ones usable, though far from visually attractive. Two legs of each of these chairs were sticks cut from tree branches Paula and I picked up when the council were pruning. They did this so vehicles, particularly buses, would not hit the trees. These makeshift seats allowed the kitchen chairs to be sold. The Friday market provided a few items worth packing and using as packing material, but only a few. We'd need to find proper cold weather clothes after getting to Canada. Gradually our house looked more and more like we were camping, but we were counting down. Maud most, and Paula second, wanted to make sure things we were shipping were well packed. Eventually all but the most dilapidated dishes, pots, pans, and utensils were in the tea chests. Friends who had taken wedding pictures were asked for double copies of prints, for which we would pay, and we put one set in a tea chest and another in one of the suitcases. At my suggestion, the three of us put together photos from our previous lives and paid a photographer to copy them for us so we could have two copies. One night at supper, I said somehow I feel more unsettled than at any time during the war. I think it's the waiting for the ROF like the racehorses waiting for the tape to go up. The others murmured their agreement. Part 69. Fred Brownlow stepped down from a ship in Southampton docks in the second week of October. Maud looked after Jack while Enid went to the dock, as we rightly anticipated the disembarkation would take some time. Fred would have leave for a number of weeks before he was officially discharged. Enid hoped he would, in that time, be able to find a job. It was a pity we'd be leaving so soon after Fred got back. Enid had said, one evening sitting in our garden drinking tea, "I'm sort of nervous that we'll have drifted apart and have trouble getting along. It's been 4 years since we've seen each other, and I'm not sure how I'll feel getting into bed with a man who's essentially a stranger." Maud said, "Better just tell Fred that. You're not saying you don't want him. Just the opposite. You're saying you want him, but you want to go forward together." "Thanks, Maud. That could help both of us. There's a whole lot of thinking and dreaming, but two separate sets of thoughts and dreams when you're that far apart for so long have got to be different." Perhaps I wouldn't have been able to suggest that before Ted came. "I never told you that we each discovered that we each had problems." He heard me weeping a few times, and I had to wake him from a nightmare. He used to have them pretty much every night, crying out and such, but one was particularly bad and I woke him. Then he said he could hear me weeping sometimes and we started to talk. And things gradually got easier for both of us. He still has the bad dreams, but now says he can wake himself up because he can realize they are dreams. And I still have weepy moments. More about Jenny than Jeremy, probably since more time has passed. but Ted and I share our feelings, and I'm closer to him than I ever was to Jeremy, who I love deeply, but we didn't really talk about emotions.
Yeah. I'd better see if I can get us to talk.
Make time to go for walks and just be together. Ask him about India and what he saw. The things that he liked and didn't, particularly if he can describe things. Maybe see if there's pictures or magazine articles or library books. You each need to know about the lives you had. And he probably knows nothing about how you were working on building landing craft at Thornycrofts like I was.
Yes. That's true.
And all the little things about Jack growing up. Jack will have to get used to having a daddy again.
Well, to having a daddy.
He was too young to know when Fred went off to war.
Part 70.
Maud and I were in bed fairly early and she was lying in my arms. Ted, I got Paula a belt today for, well, you know.
Has she started monthlies yet?
No. We had a quiet talk the other day. Surprisingly, Matilda had already talked to her about such things. And sex, enough that she asked when we might have a baby.
You told me last week we'd have to postpone some fun yesterday, so I'm guessing I've at least 9 months' grace. That got me an elbow, an awful man, but I still love you.
Well, it's good you had a chat.
Will she keep the belt and a pad or two with her?
I've told her to, just in case. Actually, I found an old flat cocoa tin at the market and thought it would be useful for something and got it for a penny hey penny. It said Hershey's, so must have been left by the Yanks. Just right for the belt and 2 or 3 pads, and it will fit in her satchel.
Maud, I hope it all goes well. I'm sure there'll be some shock at how things are different in Canada. For example, I've no idea how the schools work there, or a lot of things.
Can't be worse than we've been through, Ted.
And we're together.
Yes, we are. Though most of our household stuff should be halfway to Montreal by now. It was delivered to the docks the day Fred came home. It actually was under £500.
Just.
So there won't be any argument over Imperial or American units.
How long before it arrives?
About another 10 days, I think, at the earliest. There's a stop in Halifax and one in Quebec before they get to Montreal.
Let's hope it all arrives, Maud voiced my own misgivings.
Part 71. At midday dinner in the canteen on the 25th of October, Gooch came in and there was a bit of a goodbye for me. A crate of beer appeared and we had a few minutes of handshaking and well wishes. Back in my office, which I'd cleared out, I ushered in James Hall and we did a formal handover. I would leave work early on this day.
You were good to your word, Ted.
I'll use Ted now, since I hope we'll manage to keep contact, at least of the Christmas card and letter sort.
I'd like that. It's easy to lose touch.
Part 72. Friday night we'd had fish and chips. Didn't need plates. We'd found some military knife fork spoon sets and some tin plates and mugs that we were packing in our luggage. On Saturday morning at 9 o'clock a couple came round with a lorry and driver to get the beds. We'd given back all but one key to the council rent collector yesterday. The bicycle I'd passed on to Paula was picked up by a girl from school who'd arranged to buy it in advance. The buyer got a good price and Paula had access to a bicycle to run errands right up to our leaving. We'd already had breakfast with Enid and Fred. They seemed to be settling in, at least Enid was smiling and Fred seemed comfortable, if quiet. We gave them the rest of our food and Maud had shopped to use up all our rations. We kept the few points we had left in case we spotted something small we wanted, like some chocolate.
You'll no doubt find it takes a bit of time to get used to being home and learning about each other, I said to Fred as we moved the last of our odds and ends to their house. We told them they could do with these what they wished, even burn the chairs for heat.
Yeah. Seems strange, but Enid told me right away she wanted us to make a big success and we'd need to tell each other how we were feeling.
I hope she wasn't indiscreet.
She told me you'd had nightmares and Maud had to wake you, and that had got the pair of you to talk, so you ended up married.
Yes. Talking probably helped us get together.
And the dreams aren't such a problem now. Somehow a mix of what I saw when a V2 hit a convoy of lorries in Antwerp and thinking about how Agnes and Margaret were killed. I usually know I'm dreaming now and wake myself up.
Guess we've all seen some nasty stuff.
Fred didn't have time, or likely inclination, to elaborate.
Hope you and Jack can get to know each other too.
Yeah. I never had the chance to be a dad before.
Good luck to you, anyway.
We can all use a bit.
Part 73.
We'd booked a taxi to get to Southampton Terminus and got the train to Waterloo, then back out to Staines. We had a room booked for two nights at the Pack Horse. It had a double bed and a cot for Paula. A bit tight, but it did have a private bathroom. Our luggage made the room tighter. We'd been a bit surprised to find we were allowed £66 each and managed to find a second kit bag. One of the two we packed with just clothing so Maud could handle it and a suitcase. Still looked a bit odd, a woman in a coat and beret carrying a kit bag and a suitcase like a soldier off to war. We fixed up her handbag with a long strap so it could go over her head and tuck under one arm so she'd have hands free. We did the same for Paula with her aunt's old handbag, then decided her school satchel would be more useful in this role. The satchel had a couple of pockets and could take books, snacks, and other odds and ends. The handbag was flattened and packed in the bottom of one of the kit bags. It was of decent quality and had some memory value. The rucksack we used for coats on our honeymoon was going to be carried by Paula. It could take quite a lot, so we packed relatively heavy items in the bottom. For example, some books and our two photo albums, of which the duplicates were in a tea chest. The top would be left to put in cardigans and pullovers. The sack had a drawstring then a large flap, so such clothing could be added and removed easily. We made sure that we split up our money, with some pocket money for ready purchases. Over dinner one day in the canteen, I'd overheard someone saying that a friend emigrating had their money, possibly over the limit, in a bag that was stolen. All the family's savings. I wasn't sure this was actually a true story or one of those bits of gossip that becomes a legend. It still made a lot of sense not to have all our money in one place and to be careful how we took out purses or wallets.
Part 74.
It was about 3:30 once we were established in the hotel. As we registered, I arranged for a taxi to Heathrow for Monday morning at 6:30. The lady at the desk commented that we'd miss breakfast, but she would see if something could be put in a paper bag for us. It was at least easier for us that TCA was now flying from London rather than Prestwick. Maud had her shoes off and was lying on the bed. Paula was sitting on her cot. I'd just come out of the bathroom. There was suddenly an awkward pause.
What are we going to do until we leave, Ted? Paula asked.
I've not actually had time to think. I know I didn't want to make any specific plans.
Do you have any ideas what you would like?
We need to think of dinner, and the hotel restaurant is possible, but not the bar because you are underage.
Can we see London? Paula asked.
Maud responded, it's probably a good idea to show you around London tomorrow when we can use the whole day.
Even arranged to have dinner here tomorrow night. We'll ask today about that so we don't end up hungry. But then we can use the day well.
That would be nice, Paula said. So we need to think about tonight.
Maybe we could go to the pictures? I suggested.
That would be good, Maud agreed.
Paula nodded.
Let's go, then, I suggested.
We trooped down to the desk and made sure we could get dinner tomorrow night. The dining room didn't close until 9. They were used to aero crews. So we suggested 8 o'clock and made a reservation. Then we asked about cinemas. There were a few and the hotel had a local paper under the counter and we looked up what was on. Nearby in Feltham, we could see A Night in Casablanca by the Marx Brothers. We decided something silly like that would be better than dramas or anything that might upset sleep. And we could easily get there on the train. However, we walked along the river for a bit first because it was picturesque. Feltham didn't offer much in the way of food. There was, fortunately, a small cafe. It would close at 5:30, and we got there about 5. Not a lot to choose from. Maud and I had beans on toast, and Paula a Cornish pasty. And rather strong tea. Still, it would hold us. It was a good job Maud had the good sense to pack some sandwiches for the train. The cinema had a double feature, and the second film was a pretty standard western. I don't remember the title, and woke up from a nice nap as the lights came on.
Part 75. We made a decision to skip church and go directly to London after breakfast, to which we were the early birds. For Paula's sake, we visited many of the traditional sites and wore out our feet, even though we did take buses several times. Lions gave us food and drink. Twice, in fact, which was a bit of a luxury, but we needed a rest and a toilet. People were about, doing much as we were. In the afternoon, we did actually go inside St. Paul's. We hadn't done that when we were here. Paula suggested that we sit and spend a few minutes simply enjoying the atmosphere of the place. Apart from the issue of tired feet, it was a good day. We had dinner and Maud and I took a bath. We'd stuck to our usual days, fearing that hot water might run out if we tried all three, so Paula had bathed the night before, but she and Maud had washed their hair on Friday. Both had berets, which they pulled down a bit to avoid the smoke of the trains. Maud had packed her church hat in one of the tea chests, but she had a scarf she could wear if the beret would not go with her clothes. I noticed she had low-heeled shoes. A good idea given the walking we were doing. As I say, Maud and I took a bath. We wondered about sharing, then Paula said if you share the hotel can't complain you're using too much hot water. Somehow, I can't think of Margaret being so direct and accepting of parents sharing a bath.
Part 76. We were surprised that the terminal at Heathrow was a set of army marquee tents. There were wooden duckboards between and leading to the aprons where the aircraft were parked. Despite the tent arrangement, the setup was well organized and not uncomfortable. We had to show what money we had, and on Saturday, we had carefully made sure each of us had our allowed amount set aside. We attempted to spend the rest, in fact paying for the hotel a day early on Sunday morning so we would know how much we were over the limit and could spend the rest. By Sunday afternoon, we still had a little over £4 in my pocket purse. Maud and Paula had given me their excess so we had everything together apart from a penny each for the toilet. I figured 10 shillings more than enough for the taxi on Monday morning, including a good tip. So we had £3.10. The off-licenses will close soon, Maud said. It was about 2:40.
Is that one over there?
Paula asked. It was, and we went in and bought a bottle of brandy and a single malt whiskey, leaving us with about 0.5 crown.
we used that, and our last points, on some Cadbury fruit and nut bars. The shop assistant's eyes were wide when we bought out the last he had. Little did we know they would also be the last we would see, since Canada didn't have them. So at Heathrow, we showed our money and Maud and Paula had to open their handbags or, in Paula's case, her satchel. American Coco, the official asked. Paula blushed and stammered no. As Maud leaned forward and whispered something to the man. He smiled and said, I've a daughter too. Miss. Just open the top a tiny bit and let me see and we'll say we're done. I was asked to empty one pocket. However, the fact we had our money organized and were a family leaving for a new life possibly saved us a more rigorous inspection. Of course, there were my 10 sovereigns. I decided not to carry them on the airplane. They were, in fact, tucked in the thick top hem of some curtains we packed in one of the tea chests. Paula didn't know this, but Maud did. The cloth was thick enough that you couldn't feel them, and Maud had sewed up the hems carefully. There was a risk they'd not make it. As I've indicated, the war made us all a bit less upright. Part 77. Ted! Over here! We'd staggered off the Lancastrian after 15 hours of noise and some bumping around. Well, some of that was on the ground refueling at Gander, Newfoundland. The flight had not been a bad one, but Merlin's don't have an exhaust pipe, just a stub for each cylinder. All 48 of them, of which half are facing the cabin. The service on the aeroplane was very good, and we were fed well. Better, in fact, than many restaurants. An immigration official took our document and stamped it and said welcome to Canada. It was evening, and near supper time, so customs made a show of asking me to empty my kit bag onto the inspection table then put it all back. But that was the only bag they asked about, and they didn't dig around once things were out. Mostly clothing, and no particular packing system. A minor nuisance. Then we were out into the main part of the building, which was better set up than Heathrow's tents, though those had been quite well organized, just tents. They'd be cold in winter, especially the nasty one that would be coming to England at the beginning of 1947. Of course, we learnt about that later. Ted. There was 50. Hello, 50. Here's Maud, my wife, and Paula, our daughter. And plenty of luggage. 50 grabbed the larger kit bag. Come on, we'll get you to your new home. We followed 50 out to a road that circled in front of the building and to a large car. Boy, am I glad my dad and I bought this 38 Dodge Vador before the war started. Cars are starting to be made, but lots of people want them, and this beauty is good because it has lots of room and plenty of trunk space. Trunk? Maud said. You call it a boot, 50 said. But nobody here'll understand that. And this is a fender, not a wing, he added, tapping one of them. We got in, feeling awkward because it was facing what we perceived as the wrong way, and 50 started the obviously big engine and we moved off. It was already dark now. 50 gave a running commentary, but I think all of us were still woozy from the long flight. It didn't take long to our destination on a residential street of two-story houses, clearly in wood. 50 pulled into the driveway of one with a hip roof, the upper story being covered in roofing. I discovered later that it was shingles. Rare in British roofs. Here we are, 687, 25th Avenue. 50 also repeated it in French, and would need to learn how to say it that way too. We were ushered inside with our luggage and introduced to Mart, Lise, and Denise. English and French seemed to get all mixed up, but Paula, who now became Paul again, was in her element. Liz was about a year younger than Paul, as we later learnt one day less than a year younger. Our rooms were two of the upstairs bedrooms. Mart used the front room downstairs. There was a dining room, which was now also the living room, and a quite big kitchen on the main floor. Upstairs Maud and I would have the front room, Paul the next and Liz the smallest. There was also a bathroom with a clawfoot tub. And here the toilet wasn't separate. The house was cozy. We learned later that Unri had got one of the earliest oil furnaces. It made for a very convenient and comfortable house. The only discomforts would be the social and linguistic adjustments. I realized I owed 50 some money and whispered, "When can we settle up?" "For sure not tonight. Get a good night's sleep and I'll come by for breakfast and we'll set you on track. I've a busy day, so you'll be on your own or with Mart. But given what we did in France, Belgium and Holland, you'll get organized quickly. The first thing I'll need to do is get some money changed and a bank account." "Yeah. That's important, and you should be able to do that tomorrow. There's a Bank of Montreal nearby. Probably as good as any." Though we'd eaten, Mart had some pea soup for dinner. She said it's a pay, and it took a while before I realized it was supper, not about soup. More to learn. After we'd eaten the soup, Denise said in French, "They're completely exhausted, Lawrence. They need to be allowed to sleep." She pronounced 50's name with a decided accent. We'd need to tune our ears to the different pronunciations here. Indeed, we were falling off the chairs, so we proceeded up to our rooms, and within 15 minutes were asleep. Part 78. I woke when it was still dark. Pulling the curtain aside, I could reach a corner of the window from in bed. I saw a sliver of dawn. "You awake too, Ted?" "Just now."
"Have you been awake long?"
"No. About 5 minutes."
"What time is it?"
I picked up my watch from the bedside stand.
"Just gone. 11.
The purser on the aeroplane said there was a 5-hour difference, so it's just gone 6. We don't have to get up quite yet." I offered my arm and Maud scuttled in. "I love you, Maud," I said, mimicking how Mart and Denise said her name.
"Guess I'll get used to it.
And to Paul instead of Paula."
"Ted, do you think Paula, Paul, should go to French school?"
I was talking to that diplomat fellow on the plane when we stopped in Gander. Couldn't really talk easily other times. He said the school system in Quebec is divided on religious grounds, with the Catholic Church really hanging on to their control, mainly with French schools. And I don't know if he was prejudiced. I didn't let on we were Catholics. But he said the church more or less only gave girls about 7 years of schooling, then generally expected them to get married and have hordes of good Catholic babies. Some sort of expression that translates to the revenge of the cradle. We'll need to see whether that's got any truth.
So the English education is under the Protestants?
It seems so, and the Jews tried to set up their own schools, but now muck in with the Protestants. I got a hint that English Catholics do too. Maud said Paul speaks French, but probably the French of a child, and from France, not here. Her grammar and spelling could be a big handicap, and she'd already be about to leave school too. I'm not sure religion should interfere with education.
Me neither.
But maybe we give Paul a chance to decide. If she is already nearing school leaving age, there won't be a truant officer breathing down our neck. The diplomat Waller said a lot of people send their kids to private schools. Apparently private day schools aren't that pricey here. Part 79. We came down to breakfast at about 7:45. Liz was getting ready for school and had just finished eating. She went upstairs to the bathroom, I think to brush her teeth, then yelled, "A plus tard.
See you later."
and was out the door just as 50 came in with a bag of groceries. "In case Mart didn't get out," he said, kissing her on the cheek. In French, she said, "Sit down, Lawrence."
"You too, Ted."
Maud and Paul were right behind me and we sat at the kitchen table, which had 6 chairs around it. Mart poured coffee and put it in front of us. There was milk. Actually, it turned out to be a sort of cream. And sugar. Maud and I didn't know quite what to do. Paul did. She added cream and some sugar, as did 50, so we copied them. Paul said in French, "It's a lot less strong than the coffee in Paris 6 years ago. But I like it." Mart replied in French, "Yes. That's likely. The French like dark coffee." Mart opened the oven and there was a luxurious smell of bacon. She put a big plate of crisped streaky bacon on the table with a bowl of scrambled eggs and a plate of toast.
"Bon appetit."
50. "Does Mart know that's a whole month's ration in England?" 50 tried to explain. Paul had more success, but it was clear Mart did not quite believe her. Sacrament was her eventual conclusion.